From PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. Hello, I'm Keith Parron. China's notorious re-education through labor camps will soon be a thing of the past. The decision to close them puts an end to the controversial punishment system, long criticized for its human rights abuses, with people often being held there for years without trial. Human rights groups claim there are as many as 160,000 inmates being held at 260 camps at the start of 2013. Hui Fren-tae reports from Beijing.
The notorious camps, thought to have been based on the Soviet gulags, were set up in the 1950s to punish critics of China's Communist Party. It allowed authorities to send anyone to prison for up to 4 years without a trial, with the labor camp sentence almost impossible to appeal. Over the years, the camps gained a bad reputation amid allegations of human rights abuses. So many, both inside and outside China, welcome moves by the Chinese leadership to get rid of the system. Lei Jianbing is from the Chinese lawmaking body known as the National People's Congress. Lao Jiao has become less applicable over the past few years, and the applicable period is also shortening, he says. In fact, in March this year, many areas in China had stopped using Lao Jiao. Most of those detained in the labor camps were arrested for drug offenses, either selling or buying small quantities of illegal narcotics. However, others held included people deemed as troublemakers. One such case involved a mother who was sent to a camp after she tried to seek justice for her daughter, who had been kidnapped and raped. Another was Li Xuehui, who spent 12 months inside one Beijing facility in 2010 for causing trouble. Mr. Li was sent there for throwing so-called ghost money, or sheets of paper used for ancestral worship, in Tiananmen Square during U.S. President Barack Obama's visit in 2009. Someone would take note of my activity every 30 minutes, even if I was just sleeping, he says. I sat on a stool all day, either writing a report or writing something expressing my remorse. There's little detail about a community-based correction system that will replace the labor camps, some of which are to be transformed into drug rehabilitation centers. But human rights activists and lawyers have their reservations, as does former detainee Li Xuehui. If the lawmakers don't pursue the unconstitutionality of re-education through labor, then how can they come up with a replacement that does not violate the constitution, he says. Chinese state media say all those currently serving time will be set free and will not be forced to serve out the remainder of their sentences.
The Australian daughter of a man being held in a Pakistan jail on blasphemy charges has appealed to both the British and Australian governments for help. Her father, who's in his 70s, has dual Pakistan-British citizenship. He was arrested in Lahore at a clinic in late November. His family say he's being targeted by Muslim extremists. Tom Fayle reports.
Masood Ahmed is a member of the minority Ahmadiyya community. The religious sect faces discrimination and worse in many Muslim countries. But the persecution is particularly severe in Pakistan. Ahmadis can face hefty prison sentences for what's termed behaving like Muslims. They're also the frequent target of attack by extremist groups. These days, their mosques and even graveyards require heavy security. According to his Australian daughter, Masood Ahmed's crime appears to have been reading a verse from the Quran.
My father is a homeopathic doctor and he practiced in his clinic in Lahore. And two men posed themselves as patients and after taking medicines, asked him to explain them a verse from Quran. When my father read the verse, they secretly taped and used it to make a police case. And then police arrested my father on extreme pressure from Muslim extremists.
Sophia Ahmed says despite his age and poor health, the courts have so far refused to grant her father bail, accusing the judiciary of bowing to pressure and threats from outside. Masood Ahmed lived in Britain for more than 20 years before returning to Pakistan in the late 70s to work in community health.
He was living very peacefully and he was very happy and he was, serving the people and practicing as a doctor and no problem.
Do you believe he was targeted? He was set up?
Yes, I believe, yeah. He also found a mark on his car and outside the shop.
Is there anything else, do you think, at play here, other than the fact that he's a member of the Ahmadi community?
No, it's just because he's Ahmadi.
Sophia Ahmed says while her father's health is failing and he is in urgent need of medical attention, he remains strong mentally.
The BBC just talked to him and I talked to her. She was saying that he's a strong man and mentally he's good, but health is getting weak. Health is not good.
Masood Ahmed's family says their lawyers are hopeful he will be allowed out of prison once the bail application reaches the country's High Court. But his daughter in Australia says international pressure is essential to ensure he gets a fair hearing when the case does eventually go to trial.
We requested the Home Office in London and British High Commission in Islamabad, but their help is limited at this stage. The High Commission staff had visited my father in jail, but we want at least ensure my father gets fair treatment and fair proceeding in court. My father and my other five siblings are British citizens, and we need government support in getting a fair treatment for my father. I just also want to request Australian government to speak to the Pakistani authorities and please help me release my father. His health is declining every day in jail.
The New Zealand government has been warned and faces possible legal action and a boycott of fish exports unless it boosts protection for the critically endangered Maui dolphin. This small species of dolphin is only found in New Zealand waters, but is on the brink of extinction with only 55 adult dolphins left. Dominic Schwartz has more from Auckland.
The Maui's dolphin lives off the west coast of the North Island. It's a subspecies of the more populous Hector's dolphin found further south. To the eye, they look the same. But you're unlikely to see a Maui's because it's the world's rarest dolphin.
So there's probably around about 12 or 14 breeding females. So this is as endangered species get. So unless we do the right things, they could be gone within a decade or two.
Professor Steve Dawson from Otago University has spent 3 decades studying New Zealand's dolphins with his colleague, Dr. Liz Sluton.
The safest thing to do with these animals would be to get rid of all of the entangling fishing technologies out in water less than 100 metres deep.
The New Zealand government agrees that set nets, or gill nets, are the dolphins' biggest threat. The Primary Industries Minister recently increased the area in which such fishing is banned. But he hasn't gone far enough, according to Dr. Sluton.
It's likely that the minister will be taken to court for doing too little too late. He really does need to remove those nets from the whole of Maui's dolphin habitat, not just from about 10% of it.
Leading international scientific and conservation groups agree. And German-based Nabu International hopes to force the government's hand.
We are going to launch in January a fish boycott against New Zealand. Australia will be an important country in this context, as it is, after China, the second largest importer of fish from New Zealand.
The fishing industry says the extension of the Maui's protective area won't guarantee the survival of the species, but it will guarantee the loss of fishing jobs.
The industry says the government should assist seafood operators affected by any restrictions. Otherwise, it won't be just Maui's facing extinction.
In Hong Kong, tens of thousands of people have marked the start of a new year by calling for universal suffrage and the resignation of their leader. The Hong Kong government recently began a 5-month public consultation on how the city's future leaders will be chosen. China has pledged to let Hong Kong citizens pick their leaders in 2017, but there are fears that those critical of Beijing will be screened out of the nomination process. Tom Eddox has more.
2014 is set to be an important year for democracy in Hong Kong. Beijing has promised to let Hong Kong citizens pick their leader through universal suffrage starting in 2017. Afraid the promise won't be fulfilled, anti-government demonstrators have kick-started the year with a very public statement.
Well, this time in our rally, our demand is simple. We want universal suffrages, first of all, and we want a civic nomination. That means equal rights to access the competition to run for the office, and citizens, every citizen can nominate candidates that they wish.
Protester Johnson Yung is from rally organisers, the Civil Human Rights Front, a group of more than 40 NGOs and a handful of political parties. He says progress toward democracy has slowed.
This year, many poll governments, parties and organisations have done so much work to discourage the citizens to accept or to fight for a real democracy. But right now, the political reform consultations have already started for 3 weeks. So we're expecting there are more attentions on this issue because this is the time that we have to fight.
The Hong Kong government recently opened public consultation on how the city will choose its future leaders. It's a crucial exercise, and when it closes to public view in May, the Hong Kong administration will submit a reforms proposal for approval from China. But there are fears those critical of Beijing will be screened from the nomination process. The city's current leader was elected by a pro-Beijing committee, and the protesters' main concern is that Beijing will control the list of candidates who stand for election in 2017. Johnson Yung again.
If the CCP have made cracks or control the elections, I believe that Hong Kong people will be so angry and they will go for Occupy Central, which is a civil disobedience actions.
If the Hong Kong public disapprove of the proposed reforms, Johnson Yung says thousands of disgruntled people will occupy central Hong Kong, forcing the city's business district to come to a standstill. Charles Mok is a member of Hong Kong's Legislative Council, and he joined in the New Year's Day march. He says people have grown angry with the current chief executive, Long Chun Ying, often described as the stooge of Beijing.
We've had been under the rule of our chief executive, CY Leung, for a year and a half, and we have seen a large number of issues and problems that the government has been mishandling the policies in Hong Kong. For example, in the last year, we've had a number of huge protests because of the government's decision not to grant a free television license to a particular company in Hong Kong without giving any reasonable reason that anybody could understand and appreciate. And so there has been a lot of frustration and anger building up among Hong Kong people.
There's been a big community push for civic nominations, whereby citizens themselves nominate a particular candidate. But Beijing is adamant this can't take place.
I think the expectation for a lot of Hong Kong people is that we need to elect our own chief executive, one person, one vote. But we know that if they give us one person, one vote, but they screen the field of candidate in advance so that certain people that a lot of Hong Kong people may prefer to be among the candidates, but ending up that they cannot stand. That is something that we know is not going to be anything that we can consider to be real democracy.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Asia is the worst region in the world for journalists, with countries such as the Philippines and India named among the worst. Well, that's according to a report from the International Federation of Journalists, which called on governments to protect and enforce basic rights of reporters. 108 journalists were killed in 2013, a drop of about 10% from the previous year. For more, Shavia Navik speaks to Christopher Warren, the Federation Secretary of the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance.
Well, it's driven by different things in different countries. Well, we see, for example, in the Philippines, where there's almost a criminal underclass that is targeting journalists, often in cooperation with corrupt police or other corrupt authorities. Or we see in Pakistan, where journalists get caught between political uprisings or terrorist groups, and indeed also some criminal gangs. So in many places, it's driven by different things, although what brings it all together is that groups see journalists as a threat and see targeting journalists as a way of advancing their goals, whether they're criminal or political or terror-related. And as a result, journalists are increasingly being killed as a result of trying to do their job.
Asian countries such as the Philippines and India are among the most dangerous countries in the world for reporters. Why are these particular countries hotspots?
India is a very good example of what happens when you get societies in turmoil and societies in change, where even democratic societies then struggle with the ability to find the people who are targeting journalists and arrest them and charge them. Well, one of the worst things about that's happened to the attacks on journalists over the past few years is that almost no one gets charged or convicted of murdering a journalist. If we look in Pakistan, for example, I think of the almost 100 journalists that have been killed in this century, in only one case has there been a successful criminal prosecution of the person involved. In every other case, the killers of the journalists involved have got away with it. And governments worldwide have an absolute responsibility to end this climate of impunity, this sense that you can kill a journalist and get away with it.
The Pacific also faces issues with freedom of speech and media rights. Although there's no record of the number of deaths in the report by the IFJ, is the situation in the Pacific any better?
In the Pacific, generally, it can vary dramatically from country to country. One of the things that we are seeing in Australia right now is that Australian journalists working in the region, indeed working around the world, are finding themselves in far greater danger than may have been the case historically. Journalists are finding that increasingly pressure is being brought to bear on them, but we're now also seeing governments, authorities, corrupt police, corrupt organisations, terrorist organisations, also targeting foreign journalists to try and prevent foreign journalists reporting what's going on within their country.
But in terms of the larger media landscape in Asia, how do you think these kind of events or these kind of incidences actually affect the development of, you know, a better media landscape?
In many countries, the attacks on journalists reflect the fact that journalists are increasingly doing their job, that increasingly journalists are better able and more open about reporting what's going on in their societies. The problem is when journalists report what's going on in their societies, those who are corrupt or seeking to defeat democracy in their societies turn against and target journalists who are doing their job. So in many ways, the struggle for democracy is part of the attack on journalists.
Port Vila-based photojournalist Ben Bowen has spent more than two decades documenting the lives and customs of the people in the Pacific. His work has appeared in Vanity Fair, Time and Newsweek, among other publications, covering conflicts in Bougainville and the Solomon Islands, as well as the custom cult and cargo cult movements in the region. His new book is entitled The Black Islands, Spirit and War in Melanesia. He had a chance to speak to the ABC's Catherine Gao.
In looking not just at the conflict, but at the spiritual traditions that exist through this region, and in particular a focus on theology, comparative religion, the role that cult and custom movements and cargo cult movements play in this region, because they're often very underreported. And I was particularly interested in the way that some of these custom and cult movements could trigger conflict in this region, but also be the agents to stop the conflict and bring in reconciliation. There was a lot of interesting sort of spiritual traditions in this region that I was curious to look at and document. I've called the book The Black Islands simply because that is the literal translation of Melanesia, and I thought it sort of summed up a kind of mood as well of the region. I've shot it in black and white partly because, as a photojournalist, that's my interest, is to continue that documentary tradition of black and white reportage. And I thought it also acted as an interesting counterpoint to the way we normally visualize the Pacific. You know, we're so used to seeing the Pacific rendered in color with beautiful, happy, shiny people with hibiscus flowers tucked behind their ear, and I guess what I'd call the Club Med photography school, and the picture postcard version of the Pacific, which we're used to seeing. So I was hoping to sort of go a little bit deeper and reflect this region in black and white as a way of taking readers and viewers into a sort of deeper level of understanding of Melanesia. And part of that was to look at all the challenges also facing this region. As beautiful and tranquil as it is mostly, there are significant challenges in this region and conflicts over land, etc. There's, you know, a fair bit of conflict as well going on, certainly between 1994 and, say, 2004, which wasn't being documented in any substantial way. So it's good to know that I've been able to document some of that history of this region. And I've put it together in a book with the hope that you know, people might like to get beyond the picture postcard version of this region, and hopefully it will be a bit more of a mindful visual journey through this amazing region called Melanesia.
It'd be fair to say that during your 20 years throughout the Pacific, documenting all of these many varied aspects of the Pacific, you yourself have learnt a lot, as you've just described. Do you think people who pick up your book, perhaps with less of an idea about the Pacific, will be quite surprised to see this different side of the Pacific that you are portraying in your book?
I think so. I mean, I hope it takes you on a journey that is certainly more mindful and hints at some of the larger issues confronting this region. It's not all about tropical sunsets and white sandy beaches. It's also about the people and the culture and the challenges that they face and the way they're navigating out of a very tribal background into a modern world. But yeah, most certainly I hope it sort of illuminates some of the spiritual traditions, the really rich cultural and custom traditions that exist in this region and how they interact with the modern world. I'm hoping people won't see the book as you know, necessarily all about conflict, even though there is a substantial amount of that. But I thought it was important to give face to a lot of the struggles that are going on and to sort of represent some of these guerrilla groups that have been fighting for independence in places like East Timor and West Papua and Bougainville, because they hadn't really been represented in any way. But just to show the reality of life in this region beyond the picture postcard.
So looking at the book itself, you obviously have a large collection of photos from your work across the past two decades. It must have been difficult to select just a few to put in this book. Do you have a favourite then? And if so, can you perhaps tell us the stories behind that particular photo?
It'd be very difficult to choose one or two, but there are a couple of, I guess you could say, touchstone images that seem to have reverberated, and they come from particular trips. I'd have to say maybe the most amazing trip I've done in the last 20 years was moving with Central Command of the OPM in West Papua, moving through a very primordial landscape and with basically a group of bow and arrow fighters taking on the Indonesian military. And being the first sort of photojournalist into that region, I was just aware of how keen they were to look after me. But it meant visually there were an extraordinary trip, because I found myself with a group of people that had very little contact with the outside world. And so I came across Sangguma men, as we say, clever men, spiritual men through this region. And there's one photo of a guy out with his hand outstretched, standing in a penis gourd with mist behind him, which for me sort of sums up part of that journey into this very primordial landscape. It sometimes felt like I was stepping into Genesis, and this guy with his eyes sort of welcoming me was part of that sensation of moving through this region with people who are struggling in a life and death struggle for their sense of freedom. So you're moving around the highlands of West Papua with guerrilla movements that produced a number of strong images, guys with sort of cassowary feathers in their hair and smeared in pig fat and old bolt-action rifles left over from the Dutch period. And then equally, there was a couple of strong images, I think, from Bougainville. One in particular where I was moving with the Bougainville Resistance Force after the Bougainville Revolutionary Army, the guerrillas fighting for independence, had shot dead this boy in a village I was staying in. So we went out on patrol to find them. There was a couple of contacts along the way, and then a grenade was launched, and I managed to capture a photo standing behind this guy with a helmet that had cultist land graffitied on the back of the helmet. So in the image, you have this graffiti on a guy's helmet and the explosion of a grenade in the front, weapons, and it seemed to sort of sum up this nexus between some of these cult and spiritual traditions and the nature of conflict in the region. It all seemed to come together in that one frame. Equally, there's a much more sort of uplifting frame, I think, from Vanuatu during the Rom dance. I've tried to capture a lot of the great dances and rituals of this region, and one of them was the Rom dance in Ambrim Island, Vanuatu, and you have these figures dancing during the day and this one chief in the middle of them looking skywards, and it just seemed to have this moment of grace. So yeah, I'm hoping through this collection of photos that it's going to touch on a variety of emotions, from sort of fear and horror to exultant joy, if you like.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. You can catch another edition of the program Sundays at 1330 UTC on PCJ Radio International. The frequencies are for listeners in Southeast and East Asia, 9335 kHz, and listeners in North America can tune in on 11880 kHz. So that's 1330 UTC for listeners in Asia and North America. We hope you can tune in. If you want to listen to this program again or catch past editions, you can visit our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. That's www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. So on behalf of the whole team that helped put the program together, this is Keith Powell wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Until next time, so long and take care. Bye-bye, everyone.